headlines, Israeli settlers kill a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and injure 20 Palestinian residents in the East Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The Yemeni army says it has shot down another U.S. spy drone over the province of Marib. Also ahead, the World Health Organization says more than half of poorer countries receiving COVID-19 vaccines via the COVAX program do not have enough supplies to continue inoculations. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Israeli settlers and forces have attacked Palestinian residents in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The regime forces used tear gas and stun grenades, leaving 20 Palestinians injured. Two Palestinians were also arrested. Separately, a Palestinian man was killed after being attacked by settlers in the West Bank city of Nablus. In May, the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood became the focal point of tensions after the regime handed out eviction orders to several Palestinian families there. Clashes ensued, with Israeli forces using heavy-handed tactics against Palestinian protesters in the occupied territories. Rabbi David Feldman is the spokesman at the Nitri Carter International and joins us now out of New York. Rabbi, welcome. And we use the term eviction orders, you know, it may give the impression to some who are not familiar with the Palestinian cause or what's happening in Palestine that the residents of Sheikh Jarrah maybe have a dispute with their, you know, their landlord, like they violated the terms of the rent, the contract, they bought a pet inside, a noisy animal. Is the reality not the case that this is part of Israel's ethnic cleansing campaign that began in 1948?
None of this is secret. Nobody denies what's going on here. Unfortunately, this is systematically going on already for decades, and unfortunately, it's now unfolding in Gaza. Today, we have eviction orders from some homes. Yesterday, we had houses demolished. There will always be some kind of excuses, and the end of the day would be that what they really want to do is empty the place. What they didn't complete in 1948, and they want to have this free from Palestinian residents. This is embarrassing. This is so terrible. When you just mentioned what happened just today with this attacking local demonstrators, this is ridiculous. And we had something very similar just a couple of days ago when there was the settler flag march going through Jerusalem, and we had religious Jewish people protesting, and you wouldn't believe what happened with them. Police attacked them, as they attack always. They confiscated the Palestinian flags from these Jewish protesters, attacked them. There was one rabbi who was brutalized by the police, Rabbi Leibel Deutsch. This is unfortunately what is happening all the time, and we all are aware what this systematic Zionist regime is doing. But what is so sad is that, you know, what the mainstream media is doing, just showing one side of the coin. They would show, unfortunately, that famous Yaakov in Sheikh Jarrah that says that if I'm not going to steal your home, somebody else will. And unfortunately, this happens, you know, what the mainstream media is doing, giving this religious Jewish face to all of this. Every right-minded person knows and understands that none of these crimes is Jewish. None of these crimes is religious. None of these crimes can in any way be condoned by religion and by Judaism, no way.
The attacks by Israeli settlers, Rabbi, they have increased. Not that there weren't any attacks before, but they've certainly increased since the new cabinet was formed in Israel led by the new Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett. Do you see a connection between the two?
We know that Bennett is radical, and we know the settlers are radical. But it's not only the radicalism that that we see recently is what the problem is. The problem is going back so long ago, and it's all factions and all parties and all representatives. This Zionist movement to begin with was wicked, was anti-Jewish, was wrong from the very beginning. This whole concept of ignoring the indigenous population that lived there for hundreds of years, all of this is criminal. Disregarding Jewish religion is totally unacceptable, especially when this is being done by people who claim to represent Judaism and represent the Jewish people. There is no way that this state of Israel, this Zionist regime, can represent all Jews. There's no way this can represent the Jewish religion. And it's not only, we have to be very clear, it's not only the radical settler movement which is wrong. It's this entire occupation which is not Jewish.
Right. And just finally, Rabbi, I say settlers, I think squatters is to be more exact. What right do they have to be attacking Palestinians, the indigenous people of the land? What right do they have to be attacking them with such a vicious nature?
Well, certainly they have no right to do so. They have no right to do so as human beings, and they have no right to do so as Jewish people. But unfortunately, what is happening, the Zionist propaganda is managing to confuse issues. They try to get people to have people forget the beginning of this conflict, and people just see today what is happening, and then the Zionists will say, well, Arabs attack us. They simply forget what is going on. They forget what happened just a couple of weeks ago. They forget what happened a couple of decades ago. We always, and I try to reiterate this all the time, we need, when we see the conflict and we want to think how this should be resolved, we must step back and we have to see the beginning of this conflict, how this started. Jews and Muslims lived in peace. We can live in peace. It's this occupation which started the problem, and unfortunately now we just see the outcome of it, which is unfolding all the time.
Rabbi, thank you very much indeed for your contribution and your thoughts. Rabbi David Feldman there, the spokesman of the Neutral Culture International, joining us out of New York. Now, the Yemeni army says its air defense has shot down another American spy drone over the province of Ma'rib. Army spokesman Yahya Sarir said an American Scan Eagle drone was hit while flying over the Masjah region in the Ma'rib province. He said the UAV was brought down using a surface-to-air missile. This follows a separate announcement by the Yemeni army late Sunday that it brought down a spy drone of the same type in Ma'rib province. The army later released the footage showing the downing of the spy drone. Cross over to the Yemeni capital. Abdul Latif Al Washali is our correspondent there. Abdul Latif, welcome. The second American spy drone to be hit in as many days. What more can you tell us?
Thank you, Wissam. Actually, the Yemeni army's air defense managed to shut down the second American spy drone of Scan Eagle type. This a drone is manufactured by Incito, which belongs to the American company to Boeing. The unit price of this drone is almost $3.2 million. This operation was conducted using a locally manufactured surface-to-air missile, but the Yemeni army and the spokesman of the Yemeni army has not yet revealed the details of this new missile. The fighter jets of Saudi Arabia and the Saudi coalition are now hovering over Masjah, and it is a new achievement to the Yemeni army to be able to target and to shut down such drones.
Abdul Latif, do we know it's an American drone, a spy drone. Do we know who was operating it? Was it the Americans that were perhaps operating it, or do you think the pardon me, the Saudi Arabia was operating the drone?
Saudis themselves are not able alone to run such sophisticated technology. These drones are manufactured by Americans and are being run by Americans, according to military sources. The Yemeni army and the experts here, they believe that American experts are in Saudi Arabia to run and to operate such operations to control the weapons sold to Saudi Arabia. The USA has to maintain the reputation of its weapons. They are sold to Saudi Arabia, but the Yemeni army are continuously targeting their weapons, whether they were drones or maybe vehicles on the ground or air defense systems. So the Americans, they believe that they have to be operating such technologies to be able to maintain the reputation of these weapons and to be able to sell these weapons to other countries. This Scan Eagle drone is used by a lot of other countries and a lot of other armies.
Very interesting. So they could be operated by not just the Americans, but maybe another country. Abdul Latif, finally, I want to ask you about the fuel, essential fuel tankers that are waiting to be unloaded at Hodeidah port. Do we have any further information if the fuel is arriving, this vital fuel that helps hospitals, helps other sectors of Yemeni society?
According to the Yemeni Petroleum Company, it was only one oil ship that carries petrol was allowed to enter the country since the beginning of 2021, and the amount carried on this ship is not even enough for a week or 2 weeks. So the Yemenis are still suffering from the fuel crisis, and they need the Saudi and the United Nations especially to pressurize Saudi Arabia to lift its blockade. Tomorrow morning we will be witnessing a protest by Yemeni children to condemn and to slam the United Nations for its silence toward the Saudi continued violations of their rights. And they are really angry that the United Nations have removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist for groups violating children's rights. Whilst it has added the Ansarullah name, the Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war have killed more than 4,000 children in Yemen. They were bombed in their residence, and this is a great violation and a big violation of the international law, according to a human rights organization.
Okay, Abdul Latif, thank you very much indeed for that. Abdul Latif Al-Washari there, our correspondent, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Iran's president-elect says his administration supports negotiations that ensure his people's national interests, but will not limit its foreign policy to the 2015 nuclear deal. In his first news conference since winning the presidential election, Ebrahim Raisi said he prioritizes ties with neighboring countries.
Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi has highlighted the principles of his government's foreign policy in his first news conference since his election last week. Raisi took a jab at the US and Europe for the failure to live up to their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The US was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
This comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in talks in the Austrian capital to revive the accord, which has been hanging in the balance since former US President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Raisi said his government will support negotiations that ensure Iran's national interests, but also made it clear that his foreign policy will not be limited to the nuclear pact.
Maximum pressure hasn't worked on our people, and so they must reconsider and return. Our people have shown that they resist pressures, and they must know that foreign policy of our administration does not start with the JCPOA and will not be limited to it either.
And this is how he responded to calls by some Western countries for including Iran's missile program in the Vienna talks to revive the JCPOA.
Iran's regional and missile programs are not negotiable. They have not fulfilled their commitments regarding issues that have already been negotiated and agreed upon. How can they enter into new discussions?
Raisi said his administration will focus on an expansive and balanced interaction with the world and would also be open to restoring ties with Saudi Arabia.
Ties with neighboring countries will be my administration's priority. With regard to ties with Saudi Arabia, there is no obstacle from the Iranian side to the reopening of embassies within the two countries.
Raisi also touched on the Saudi-led war on Yemen, calling for an immediate end to the conflict. Tehran has stressed that it seeks to establish ties with all countries based on mutual respect. Now it seems to be seen how Western and regional countries will deal with the new administration when Raisi takes office in August after he won over 60% of the vote in last week's election.
The World Health Organization says more than half of poorer countries receiving COVID-19 vaccines via the COVAX program don't have enough supplies to continue inoculations. A senior WHO advisor said over 40 nations are estimated to have hit a vaccine shortage, with some having completely run out of doses. He added that the actual numbers might be even higher. The shortages are partly due to production delays and disruptions in vaccine supply from India. This comes as coronavirus infections and related deaths have been on the rise across Africa. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
The current heat wave and drought leave no doubt. We are living in the dangerous effects of the climate crisis, says Jessica Corbett Ryder in an article titled Surreal and Distressing. Climate experts' predictions come true with U.S. heat wave. Stay tuned for more. As what the National Weather Service described as dangerous and record-breaking heat affects 50 million people across the western United States even before the first day of summer, climate experts and activists are using the hot conditions to reiterate warnings and calls for policy change as scientists are seeing their dire predictions come true. The current heat wave and drought leave no doubt. We're living in the dangerous effects of the climate crisis, activist and former Democratic presidential candidate Tom Steyer tweeted recently. Action is urgently needed. Steyer shared a New York Times report on extreme heat that also caught the attention of Campaign for Nature director Brian O'Donnell, who warned that in the absence of bold action to address the climate emergency, this will all get much worse. O'Donnell's ominous warning was echoed by Daniel Swain, a Colorado-based climate scientist at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at the University of California, Los Angeles. We will still have a long way out from the peak of the wildfire season and the peak of dry season, Swain told the Times, adding, things are likely to get worse before they get better. The newspaper detailed some of the current conditions in the U.S. West. A heat dome is baking Arizona and Nevada, where temperatures have soared past 115 degrees this week, and doctors are warning that people can get third-degree burns from the sizzling asphalt. At Lake Mead, which supplies water for 25 million people in three southwestern states in Mexico, water levels have plunged to their lowest point since the reservoir was filled in 1930s. In California, farmers are abandoning their thirstiest crops to save others, and communities are debating whether to ration tap water. In Texas, electricity grids are under strain as residents crank their air conditioners, with utilities begging customers to turn off appliances to help avert blackouts. In Arizona, Montana, and Utah, wildfires are blazing. As National Weather Service meteorologist John Salmon put it into Associated Press, while discussing temperatures in and around Las Vegas that are expected to continue this weekend, this is pretty impressive. We're seeing all-time records fall. Swain told The Guardian that the most distressing part is that this is very much in line with predictions. Climate scientists have been repeating essentially the same messages and warnings since before I was born. Catherine Hayhoe, a Texas-based climate expert and chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy, responded similarly in comments to the newspaper. The extreme heat and the wildfires aren't surprising, but it is just surreal to see what you only ever saw before in your research studies and models actually happening in real life. And you're almost dumbfounded by the speed at which your projections have become reality, she said. A recent study co-authored by Hey Ho shows Americans associate hot, dry days and extreme drought with global warming. But many people don't reach the same conclusion about extreme rainfall or flooding, despite experts' findings. Citing survey results that suggest even though about three-quarters of Americans recognize that the planet is warming, less than half think it will directly harm them. Catherine Hayhoe told The Guardian that right now is a really important time for scientists to communicate with the public that climate change is here and climate action matters. Writing for Intelligencer, David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth, outlined what this summer could look like in California, which has seen some devastating and historic wildfires in recent years and beyond. Fire isn't neatly predictable, since it depends both on underlying conditions, moisture on the ground, and amount of dead flora, often called fuel, and a considerable amount of randomness, wind events, and ignitions, both human and natural. But while there is always the possibility that ignitions could be anomalously quiet and that a state could endure a year of off-the-charts conditions without having to fight and flee and breathe the smoke of a consumerate fire season, the outlook for 2021 isn't just bad. It is quite a bit worse than that. Even if you are modeling expectations of the record-setting recent past, across the American West, extreme drought conditions are more widespread than they have been in at least 20 years. The next category worse, called exceptional drought, typically rare, is already this year blanketing most of the West and Southwest. It's so widespread, it would probably be better called unprecedented drought, at least in age of modern record keeping. This week arrives throughout the region what is expected to be a record-breaking heat wave, with temperature warnings issued for more than 50 million people. In Phoenix, it could reach 118, and in Death Valley, 127. Already this spring, more than twice as many acres in California have burned as had by this point last year, when the state was on its way to more than doubling its previous fire record. Rerun last year's random ignitions on top of this year's underlying conditions, and you won't just have the worst season ever, but potentially something considerably scarier still. Get relatively lucky with fewer ignitions than is typical, and you're still probably in for sort of season that used to set state records and scar the memory of populations as recently as a decade or 2 years ago. Meanwhile, in Texas, the temperature at George Bush Intercontinental Airport passed 94 degrees for the sixth day in a row. It was the ninth consecutive day that the peak hit there was worse than normal, the Houston Chronicle reported recently. Noting that warmer weather is an expected result of human-caused climate change, the newspaper spoke with Texas state climatologist John Nielsen Gammon, who compared that area's higher temperatures arriving earlier and lasting longer to a rising tide. Climate in Texas is changing, said Susan Scott, state director of Nature Conservancy in Texas, adding, it really affects everything from our natural resources to our economy and our quality of life. As Common Dreams reported recently, the high heat comes as negotiations between the White House and Congress over an infrastructure package drag on, and the conditions in the U.S. West are bolstering progressive lawmakers and activists' position of no climate, no deal. According to Climate Power Executive Director Lori Lotz, the extreme heat, intensifying droughts, electric grids on the brink, and fires already burning hundreds of thousands of acres out west make clear that the need to include climate action in any infrastructure package should not be in question.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts, works, and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Ali Alevian. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali Alevian, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So June 18, 2021 was the day of presidential election in Iran, and the people participated in this election. So one of the interesting points, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, about the presidential election is that when the president is elected by the direct vote of the people, he has to go to the rahbar and be confirmed. I mean the ijaza, and the leader Ayatollah Khamenei has to approve and confirm this president. What are the criteria, brother? I mean, in order to for the people to know that this president is in the same line with the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, what criteria must they be looking for?
What are they? Look, as much as we see that the actions that he's taking, he has already received the permission from the Vali al-Faqih,
yes,
to do his actions, and inshallah,
okay,
his actions will be in accordance to the Islamic laws and in line with whatever the leader of the Islamic Ummah decides. But for us, because we have elected a person that we are not sure that all of his decisions and actions will be in the same line.
Okay.
So as much as, based on our understanding, we find that he is going in that line, so it means that he is still actually following whatever the leader of the Islamic Ummah actually believes in. But since, in case he has any diversion from the goals, from the Islamic bases and principles, so it is the time that even people through their parliament, through the people that they have elected for the parliament, can bring him down from the power.
That's right.
So this, again, another mechanism has been defined in the system, that people, again, can come in between through their representatives to bring him down. But up until then, he is still the legitimate deputy of the leader.
And the cabinet is also very important. I mean, the president's cabinet is also important because the ministers that are chosen by him, you know, has to be introduced to the parliament in Islamic system, and that the parliament has to approve them through the votes that they are doing that, whether he is qualified enough in order to take, we can say, the ministership or not. And I think here and there we could see the interactions between different, powers in Iran. I mean, for leadership from one side to the executive power, to the judiciary, and also the legislative power. And this makes the Islamic Republics of Iran very much beautiful, which is rooted in Islam, at the same time has the support of, what type of Islam are we looking for? Brother Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, I mean, because Islam has different views and viewpoints, but when we talk about Islam in the political scene of today's world, this president is going to do what? What type of Islam is he looking for?
Well, first of all, Islam does not have different viewpoints. Islam has one viewpoint.
Really?
and that is the
we do not
the
this God reality, brother.
That's because those who are interpreting the Islam,
okay,
those who are interpreting the history and the Quran, they are interpreting these things according to their own views. But Islam is what has come in the Quran, and you know, the day Imam Khomeini, when he came, one of the journalists, he asked him, like, have you made a constitution for your country, or how much time you need to make a constitution? He said the constitution was made 1,400 years ago, which was brought by the Prophet, and that is Quran. So the viewpoint is one, the worldview is one, and everything is within Islam. This is the beauty of Islam, that politics, the economics, the socialists, all those things are seen as one in Islam. These are the parts of Islam. This is within Islam. It's
okay.
Not separate. We are not secular. You know,
yes.
In the secular system.
This is important. That's why.
In the secular system, they see everything differently.
Yes.
Whereas Islam sees everything as one.
Mm-hmm.
A person who has become a president, he's
okay.
Responsible for the politics,
oh.
For the economics, for the religious,
that's right.
You know, rituals of the people, in everything. He cannot just look at the political point of, you know, the society.
So we can see some Muslim lands today. They are Muslim in nature, but they're secular,
yes.
In the politics.
They are, most
oh.
Of the time. And the
okay.
The beauty about the Islamic Republic that
mm-hmm.
You had said, like, what makes it significant, the thing that makes it significant is that in Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, what he basically he tried to do is to bring back the pure Muhammadan Islam, the system of the pure Muhammadan Islam back
right.
Into this country, in this state,
okay.
So that the state can become an ideal for the rest of the Muslim world,
oh.
For the Muslim states.
That's right.
For the rest of the world.
Okay.
And that's why we see that all these things are happening. And the main point which was said, which is walayat al-faqih, or the governance of the jurist, is because he is the representative of the imam, or the authority of God upon all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been selected by other authorities of imam,
that's
which
right.
Are mujtahideen, maraji. Because obviously we have the narrations. I don't want to go towards the narrations that we have. So the system at this point that we have, where it has everything on its place, it's a role model, and we can see it's been only 40 years, and it will advance at this time. Obviously, there are different stages according
right.
To Supreme Leader in order to make a state a pure Islamic state,
mm-hmm.
And they're still working on it. They're
yes.
Still working on it. So as a whole, what I can say is, basically, the Islamic Republic of Iran is becoming an ideal and a path, or a project that can show the rest of the world
that's
how
right.
To implement the true Islamic, you know, politics and everything, or how to deal
okay.
Or how to run an Islamic state.
So many slogans, Brother Ali, have been chanted by different candidates before the election has been held. Now that the president is elected, these slogans are going to be implemented in the society. What are your suggestions for the new president of Iran, brother, if he's gonna implement what is chanted during the campaigns?
Yeah,
and these campaigns, I think, and implementation of the slogans must be different from the secular system, because there is also a religious Shari'i part and akhlaqi part here,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Look, in an Islamic environment, when a person says something, he has to be actually loyal to whatever he said,
mm-hmm.
And he has to keep his promise.
Okay.
In case they talked about, they gave a promise to the people, they should not forget it. And it, at least when they are asked again by people, should not at least should not deny it at least.
That's right.
Look, but as the same way that they wanted people's participation in the election, they have to be back again to people and ask for their participation and involvement in different issues in the country, even in the rank of the, let's say, managements and whatever they want these people for. So it's not good to say something to people and forget it after 3 months.
That's
no.
Right.
In case you ask promise, you have to keep your promise and
okay.
Stay firm on what you have promised.
That's all right.
And you have to insist on the rule of law and rule of law in different aspects of the government. It's not good to promise something and ignore it while you are in power. And people definitely will not forget these things. And these are the reasons that sometimes we see that rate of the participation comes down.
Oh.
And we see that people actually find this,
yes,
actually lies, if it's a good word to say, from the candidates. But they see that they have not been implemented and they have not been flourished at the time,
yes,
that they were expecting.
Yeah, the participation very much becomes...
They have to keep themselves responsible and responsive to the people who elected them.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
not good to say something and ask them, invite them to the election, and right after that to forget. No, we are actually, you, the statesman,
yes,
are the representative,
okay,
of these people,
mm-hmm,
who sincerely came to the polling stations and voted for you. So it's not fair to neglect them and neglect their rights. They have seen, but they will react towards whatever you are doing and you are saying. And if you are lying, they will understand what is right and what is lying.
That's all right.
So it's good for the candidates and those who have been actually elected and the president-elect to be careful of what he said. And I think prior to that, at the time of the campaigns, they had to be that careful not to say something that they are unable to do.
The promises that are not practiced.
Yeah.
This is unfortunately what we see in all the debates
and
all around
moreover,
the world.
As Islam wants and emphasizes, and even the leader of the Islamic Ummah,
mm-hmm,
and the late leader, they all emphasize on the involvement of people in different aspects and think people and consider them as trustworthy. In case they have a problem, they should come clearly in front of the people and explain to them,
that's
look,
right,
this was what I told you, and this is the problem that I'm facing.
That's
but
right,
whatever they are saying, this transparency that I'm talking about is not something that actually is against the security, national security of the government and the national security of the Ummah.
This is what the leader has also emphasized, that the candidates and then the president-elect has to, ask for administering social justice, combating corruption, or, for example, strengthening domestic production, which is now in Islamic Republics of
the
Iran,
immediate need of
important.
The people.
Yeah, immediate need of the people is that. And we know that we are under sanctions. So what is important is this, believing in this domestic power. I think the president has to believe in this domestic power of the
very
people
true.
Very much. And
very
domestic
true.
Production. The case is that somehow overtrust on the foreign powers will make us neglectful of the powers inside, and this is very important. From the other side, the international interactions with the other countries are also approved by the whole system of Iran. Sometimes people think that we have to cut our ties with the world, but this is not true.
Avoiding
we are not an island.
Very true. With regard to what you said, in avoiding the imports that actually damaging the economy of the Islamic Ummah, actually, this is among the priority of those who actually want to focus on the power of the people inside and strengthening the domestic economy. So this is one aspect that they have to, because we have, based on the statistics, the country is being damaged economically through the unlawful imports from other countries for the products that we have inside.
Yes.
So this is very important. As for equality and justice, we should not look at it as a motto and a slogan, because this has to be sensed by people. So it should show its, results in the society. We have
That's
to see that the unemployment rate is decreasing. We have to see that the people's, actually, welfare is increasing. These are the things that people can easily judge about.
Okay, that's all right. Said Mohsen Naqvi, any final points, any final comment? Thank you much, brother
Ali
Alabian. And Said Mohsen Naqvi, we hope that the next president, or the then president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is successful, is implementing his programs, and power is really deceiving, brothers, brothers.
Very true.
You know, we could see that at the early Islam, we had so many loyal people and companion to Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali who were deceived by a penny, who were deceived by a dirham, just for one dirham. We could see what happened in Karbala, tragedy,
mm-hmm.
The people that were looking only for the mundane life. those people who take the power in Islamic lands, you have to take care a lot about the position you have, about the lawful means that you have, and try not to be deceived by the traps of this world, and be loyal to the people, and be loyal to the vote that the people, we can say, gave to you in the polling stations and the voting system of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Iran Call of Islam page, also YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
White Americans who hold racist beliefs are significantly more likely to endorse aggressive military interventions over diplomacy or economic strategies in foreign countries at odds with the United States if the residents of those countries are perceived as non-white. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Vladimir Enrique Mendesia and David Ebner, authors. This article is published under the heading, Racial Bias Makes White Americans More Likely to Support Wars in Non-White Foreign Countries. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Of American racial bias and anti-Asian sentiment do not end at the nation's borders. The racial attitudes of white people also influence their support for American military intervention abroad, according to working paper on U.S. foreign policy and racism. White Americans who hold racist beliefs are significantly more likely to endorse aggressive military interventions over diplomacy or economic strategies in foreign countries at odds with the United States if the residents of those countries are perceived as non-white. This is particularly true when it comes to China. Researchers have long known that race and racism powerfully shape white Americans' views on domestic issues like social welfare and criminal justice. Scholars have given less attention to how the racial resentment harbored by white people influences their foreign policy views, in part because the typical voter care less about foreign policy than about domestic policies that affect their everyday lives. But when tensions between the U.S. and another country escalate, as they have lately with North Korea and China, popular interest in foreign policy rises. That can influence policy decisions. Analyze how racial attitudes affect support for U.S. military action abroad. 30 years of public opinion data have been collected by one of the country's longest-running national public opinion surveys, the American National Election Study. The analysis focused on answers by white Americans from 1986 to 2016. Specifically, the examination was done and the responses to the racial resentment scale. Social scientists use this meticulously tested set of questions to assess anti-black prejudice in the post-civil rights era. In the recent decades, white Americans have become less willing to express explicitly racist views, such as opposing interracial marriage or supporting segregation, but they may still harbor bigoted perceptions doubting black Americans' work ethic or commitment to self-reliance, for example. The racial resentment scale is designed to capture this kind of discriminatory anti-black views. Social scientists have repeatedly demonstrated that white people who hold such views are also likely to hold negative views of other non-white U.S. populations, including Latinos, immigrants, Muslim Americans, and Asian Americans. Based on responses to the racial resentment scale in the most recent American national election studies administered in 2012 and 2016 to about 3,000 non-Hispanic white respondents each, it was found that racist attitudes are correlated with and meaningfully influence white Americans' support for U.S. military interventions in other countries. For example, people with racist attitudes favored more aggressive action against China or North Korea. 35% would support bombing nuclear development sites in different countries, compared with 15% of whites with less racist attitudes and 31% of white Americans overall. White Americans with racist views also favor military engagement against Muslim populations. Because a number of factors influence people's foreign policy opinions, including educational status, income, gender, ideology, military service, and partisan affiliation, it was adjusted for these in the study. It was also controlled for respondents' reported attention to political news, their level of white ethnocentrism, and their authoritarian leanings. It was found that racial resentment has a significant effect above and beyond these other variables. Racial resentment seemed specifically influential in white American views of China, which has become an economic and political competitor to the U.S. over the last decade. In 2012, of the 3,196 white Americans surveyed in the American National Election Study, 28% believed that China posed a major military threat to the U.S. 53% saw China as a minor threat, and 19% did not see China as a threat. Racially resentful whites were 36 percentage points more likely to see China as a major threat than other white respondents, according to the analysis. In 2016, 3,505 white Americans answered the same survey questions about China. 45% saw China as a major threat to the U.S., and 43% saw it as a major minor threat. Only 11% of whites believed that China presented no threat to the U.S. Again, racial attitudes strongly shape these perceptions. The analysis found that whites with racist attitudes were 20 percentage points more likely to consider China a major threat in 2016 than other whites. While at first glance, this might suggest that racial attitudes were less of a factor in 2016 than 2012, the lower percentage reflects the fact that a much higher percentage of Americans view China as a threat in 2016 and 2012. This trend continued during the presidency of Donald Trump, who portrayed China as a great adversary, calling it a threat to the world. Today, 22% of all Americans see China as the greatest enemy of the U.S., according to a 2020 Gallup poll. Americans' growing perception of China as a threat comes as both countries compete for control over the South China Sea. China and the U.S. routinely deploy weapons and engage in military planning and exercises in South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden frames tensions between the two countries as a competition between democracy and autocracy. He described relations with China as one of the top priorities of his administration. Many analysts, including high-ranking U.S. military personnel, view the risks of violent conflict between the U.S. and China as relatively low. But all that saber-rattling in the South China Sea and years of heated presidential rhetoric under Trump have domestic implications. Studies suggest that when politicians describe the relationship between the U.S. and China as a great power competition, it stokes anti-Asian beliefs among white Americans. These anti-Asian beliefs, in turn, make white Americans more likely to see China as a major threat. According to their research, one potentially worthy going to war over. This document is a vicious cycle of racial animosity with potentially global consequences.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.